With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and this week's guest is Karen Nelson-Field. Karen is the CEO of a company called Amplified Intelligence. They're an exceptionally interesting ad measurement company, and they focus heavily on attention. And this is something that Karen has been working on in academia, and it's something that I think the industry has grappled with for many years, and Karen has found an interesting solution, I think. So a little bit of housekeeping from us. In September, we will be launching our annual CTV advertising guide for 2022. If you'd like to be involved in that, now is the time to let us know. So if you want to get in touch via the Video Week website, we can hopefully have you involved. Okay, so now I'll pass over to my conversation with Karen, and I hope you enjoy. So, Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, delighted to have you here. So, before we sort of crack into things, I'm curious about your experience of the pandemic. In fact, I know a little bit about your experience of the pandemic. And, yeah, can you just give an overview of what you've been going through in Australia, or not going through?
I always feel a little guilty when I talk about that. We're kind of fortunate that our government sort of locked us down for a month really early on. So right back in March, I was in London actually when it was called a pandemic and sort of had to get an emergency flight home on the 13th. And pretty much our government sort of shut us down and none of us returned to work for about 6 weeks, but it pretty much annihilated it, to be honest. We've been quite fortunate in that way. So, there's a couple of bursts here and there. In fact, there's one in Sydney at the moment, but I think the burst is about 8 cases.
Horrific.
So when that happens, the government comes back in and shuts it all down. And, you know, so, I mean, we've been very fortunate, and I feel always a little guilty about sort of talking to people overseas who have had it quite badly. And we're sort of still free to roam around. I mean, obviously we can't travel. So I do know that our government is not going to allow us to travel potentially for another year and a half, another year. So that's a bit of a downer, but it's certainly eliminated here. So we're quite fortunate. But I look forward to going back to Cannes. I mean, it's on now, right? So this is my second year in the virtual space. So yeah, I look forward to going back and meeting people in the conference circuit.
It is. I think everyone's missing it. And all those conferences that I used to complain about going to, they're starting to realize that actually they're the things that add the spice to life and make it all worthwhile. So firstly, I'm really curious about your academic background. And I think that even though we're going to be talking about your new company, I'm really curious about the fact that you've come out of academia to start this. So could you maybe just tell us a bit about what you were researching to begin with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's important to know that I wasn't a career academic. So I didn't actually do my PhD until I'd worked in, you know, Diageo, News Corp, the Australian Tourism Commission. So I had industry background, did a PhD when my children were fresh, really just born, and really enjoyed it. And the PhD was looking at cross-platform segmentation, sort of trying to understand whether targeting was worth it. Also trying to understand, you know, how fragmentation has played a role in the problems that we see even today in our ecosystem. So it was a really great starting point. I was always a media girl, so it was a great starting point. And I was offered a postdoc and decided to stay. So I ended up being an academic for 10 years, but it was a really interesting time for me because, you know, my original PhD was legacy media, but it was even before, you know, I mean, Facebook was a fresh fresh out the box before it was even IPO'd or anything like that. So I sort of noted a whole lot of new media that was coming in. And my question at the time, because I was with Ehrenberg Bass, who, you know, is famous for how brands grow, my questions were, well, will brands grow the same in new media? So I sort of embarked on this really big postdoc session around, you know, how does advertising work in new media? You know, will brands have the same opportunity? Does reach work the same? You know, and then it sort of quickly evolved, as you can imagine, it really quickly evolved because I uncovered some things that industry hadn't really thought of. I mean, digital as an advertising platform generally was fairly new. So it sort of elevated my opportunity as an academic. So I got promoted quite quickly because I picked, you know, things like I wanted to understand the, you know, whether likes were worth sort of, you know, going out and trying to acquire. I wanted to understand the value of that to a brand. I wanted to understand whether the MRC standard was, you know, of value or whether it was, you know, potentially, I guess, not good enough for advertising. I wanted to understand things like my first book actually was on emotion. So I was right at the time when YouTube sort of went big and the whole concept of, you know, put a cat on a skateboard and it will go viral. So I went in and had a look at the nature of content diffusion and quickly uncovered that actually the concept of virality is pretty much a made up word and that seeding is more important. And then you get a long tail. So it was a really great training ground for me, if I'm honest.
So you mentioned Ehrenberg Bass there, that it's an institute is my understanding, but you hear an awful lot about it. Like I said, how brands grow is probably the thing that it's most commonly associated with internationally. But what exactly is Ehrenberg Bass?
So look, it was, it's essentially a research agency, but it's housed within a university system. So it was fantastic training ground for me because basically its whole sort of agenda is to look for, I guess, norms and things that generalize, you know, and they taught me a lot. So, you know, research that generalizes is, you know, much more meaningful for industry and much more predictable. So, you know, I've taken on a whole lot of those types of learnings into the work that I do now. So we actually translate a lot of the rigor that I learned as an academic in that particular institute into the business we have. But basically they are funded by industry, they get sponsorships, and they're a research agency, but deliver back into the academic world.
And on that, the notion of academic rigor, it's something that you see come up quite often, particularly people like Mark Ritson and Byron Sharp, who are often having very entertaining Twitter scraps with industry folk. And there seems to be a bit of a tension between what academics sort of feel that they know, and they've sort of developed empirical models to establish this is the way things work, and with the industry's latest fad or fashion. But what are the main things that academics, when they look at the industry, they sort of feel that they have the empirical knowledge to prove that things work in X, Y, Z way, but the industry is saying something completely different.
Look, so I'm fundamentally opposed to any of those tweets. I feel, you know, our friends in the industry are intelligent. They're just time poor and they need solutions, right? So I would never sort of, bring on my academic background and use it in a way that sort of, you know, belittles, that's for sure. But look, it's an interesting one because I left the university out of frustration, if I'm honest. So, you know, I knew towards the end, I knew that there was going to be a measurement problem. And here we are 4.5 years later, and this is what's happening. I'll talk about that later, but I could see it. And, you know, I knew as an academic, I didn't have the ability to you know, do anything in the application space. So, you know, academics might get frustrated with industry, but I think industry equally get frustrated with academics because, you know, it's a whole lot of, or a little less conversation, a little more action, thanks. So I feel that academics, you know, if you can't actually be in the industry and you know, talk the walk, then don't talk the talk. I think there's a perfect balance. And that's what I've tried to do as an organization, is to sort of say, look, you know, I mean, we're an attention measurement business, right? And attention measurement is new. So for me, it's important as an academic of academic background is to make sure that what we're actually selling, if you like, is a valuable metric for the industry. So I was only on a conference the other night with the Attention Council and talked about the need for generalizability or generalizable findings in our industry. So for me, the last 4.5 years of my life have been really, really large projects across 6 different countries to make sure that actually attention is related to business outcomes. And obviously we found that it is. So for me, it's a bit of a balance, but you know, I definitely value the rigor of the academic institution, but I also value the ability to be agile and to build things and to, you know, make change, because research alone doesn't do that.
Yeah. I think in any academic discipline, you get people who are slightly detached from the real world. And if they had to put their ideas, I mean, even if somebody studied politics at university, you would get a lot of professors who, they're great at the critique, but if it were to take their ideas into the real world, they'd probably end
walk
up
the walk.
Quite different. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you've started your own company, Amplified Intelligence. Mm-hmm. You sort of touched on it there, but could you tell us a little bit more about why you started the company and what part of the market you're going to be focusing on?
Yeah, it started because, to be honest, as an academic, I was asked by a very, very large advertiser to try and solve the problem that not all reach is equal. I mean, they didn't articulate it in that way, but basically they were frustrated with the lack of single source data to sort of be able to sort of say, is platform A better than platform B? Is platform B better than platform C? And I won some funding while I was still at the university and did a research project that worked, even though it was clunky, it worked. And it was with early, early technology. And it just made me realize that, you know, if one of the biggest advertisers in the world is coming to an academic to try and solve a problem because the ecosystem's broken, then there has to be something in there outside of the academic walls. So I made a decision to leave. I started Amplified Intelligence. And I knew, like I said all along, that there was going to be a major crash in the concept of audience measurement. Apart from the fact that, you know, cookies are crumbling, there's also lack of ability to understand value across different platforms. So, you know, a reach point isn't commensurate of outcomes, and you know, nor is, you know, any of the other proxy metrics that come along with it. So I sort of thought about what's the ultimate way to measure human engagement, because at the end of the day, that's what they're all wanting to do. And, you know, obviously attention is that. So attention, I call it a bit of a top of the tree, you know, measurement that sort of looks down and, you know, everything else tries to replicate human attention. But I thought, well, maybe I should try and build something that gives us human attention. And at the time it was pretty, you know, there were a few goggle systems around in lab, but I went on and said there has to be a better way. So I was introduced to the concept of computer vision and quickly built a team that would enable a collection app to sort of collect footage while someone's looking at a mobile or a TV, or we did PC and tablet at the time as well. So fast track to 4.5 years, we have quite a deep collection app that can collect a number of things while you're on a mobile phone. It takes facial footage and then it translates to attention scores. So yeah, and we kind of cross check that against, as I said, a lot of business models and business outcomes, including sort of both short term and long term impact measures. So yeah, that's what we do.
So how does it work in terms of the panels? I mean, how do you assemble them? How do you balance the type of people who are going to sort of opt in to the panels? And then is this like measured in a lab environment, or is it like an app on their phone and they, you know, monitor what the,
So there's a whole chapter in my book. I'll make sure I send it to you, but it talks about, you know, the methods, research methods, and what can make or break a collection and what can sort of add bias, right? So we were I was really determined to make sure that I minimized all the bias possible. And one of those, which you just mentioned, is labs. So there was no way I was going to build something that was real or meaningful in some sort of lab system where you're teaching people to do what you need them to do. So I needed to build a collection system that people could have on their phones, on the bus, you know, not in the car, that's not appropriate, on the bus, at home, whatever they were doing.
A little bit of car.
yeah, hopefully not the car, as a passenger. So we built, to your point, we built an app system. And the beauty of an app system is we actually don't have ongoing panels, and I'll tell you a bit about why. Because again, it teaches people that, you know, if you're sort of tapped on the shoulder and you go to this app, you're going to be filmed and you probably be asked some questions after. So let me just explain how it works. So if we just sort of think of it basically like an app that you download, we pay you money to do it. We say to you, you know, pick a couple of platforms that you want to go to, just, you know, use them as you normally would. And basically what happens is it gives us permission to do three things. So we're a bit like Moat in that we collect data from the device. So we can tell, we put code on the back of ads, so we can tell if someone's scrolled fast, we can tell if someone's pushed their phone to a horizontal orientation versus a vertical orientation. We can tell how many pixels on screen, you know, spatial clutter, sound, earphones, all that sort of stuff. It's also then a little bit like a video player. So we can actually pull ads out of your Facebook feed that you wouldn't even know. And we replace them with test ads. And we did that originally because we wanted to be able to hold creative constant across all of the different platforms. And then the third thing, which is the most important part, is that the camera in your device is rolling at the time, and that's taking facial footage. And what happens is that all of that data comes back to our central stack, and the footage goes through our gaze models essentially and produces three levels of attention, which is, are you looking at the ad, or are you looking at the screen but not the ad? We call that passive. And then non-attention. So active attention is looking at the ad, passive attention is looking around the ad but on the screen, and non-attention. So, you know, over the years, we've managed to rebuild and retrain the models because of all the data we keep collecting, we keep improving and improving. So our error is quite small, and we're really proud of how seamless the process is.
And to what extent do you see major differences between different types of people? Would an extremely well-educated woman on Facebook behave all that differently to a teenager?
Yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
So what's important to know is, so we've done it so far in six countries, about to go to our seventh, and we dip in and out. So, you know, we'll go back and refresh our data sort of once a year. But what's important to note is the platforms themselves operate pretty systematically. So and we know that because the functionality of the platform is what drives attention, quite frankly. So the actual formats or the overall scores at a really aggregated level are fairly consistent across time, unless there's a major functional change. But to your point, when you get down to the individual level, I mean, for example, youth pay far less attention than older people, and gender does play a role. So I'm sorry, but men typically pay less attention than women, which is, you know, good. Obvious.
Well, believe it.
Yeah. No shit. Sorry, I'm supposed to swear.
You're allowed to swear on this podcast, yeah.
I'm sorry, big pardon. I thought that was worth it. Yeah, so there's a lot of differences at the, and we are doing some work on an ethnicity with OMG, and, you know, we can see there are differences there as well. So, you know, for brands, those differences are really, really meaningful. But from a platform perspective, they're relatively systematic at an aggregated level.
Yeah. And to what extent is this, do the same behaviors play out according to different campaigns for different advertisers on the different platforms? Or is it very individualized depending on the creative, the campaign,
Yeah. So it's predictable. I'll let you know that. So what I can tell you is that attention and outcomes are not perfectly linearly related. And the reason why that is because even if you get attention, if your creative is not distinctive and is not well branded, they may misattribute that creative to your bigger competitor. So that's an Ehrenberg-Bass principle, or an Ehrenberg principle, I should say. So my point is that creative does play a role, but less so than you think. We can see in the data that, you know, if you have a brilliant Cannes Lion winner creative and you put it on platform A, which gets you 10 seconds of attention, the same ad will get you fewer seconds relative to the functionality of the platform as you go down. So by the time you get to platform D, which is a pretty average platform, it's still not going to give you as many seconds as platform A. So my point is creative does play a role, but it's not the driver of attention. It helps, but it's not the driver.
I don't think we've got a huge creative audience.
I hope not.
I think most people would be quite happy to hear that. So, you know, we are talking about a lot more than just viewability. Do you think viewability is to some extent being used as a sort of proxy metric for attention, or maybe misused as a proxy metric for attention? Maybe not.
I'm just trying to. Yeah. So it's not being misused. So it's funny because I have this conversation quite publicly a lot, and I have to say, you know, we've come from a world, you know, I'm probably older than you. So, you know, I started when this research before, you know, Facebook was in nappies, you know. So, you know, we've gone a long way in measurement. And, you know, before the concept of viewability, particularly the moat metrics and things like that, it was a really unruly, you know, it was unfair to advertisers, and it was an unruly system. So, you know, all credit to the MRC, who have brought some sort of regulation back, and viewability is a part of that. So I look at viewability and think it's done a fantastic job at herding cats. And at least as an advertiser, there is at least some sort of guarantee that it might have a human in front of it. Before that, definitely not. But what I do see is that it's not good enough anymore. So it is definitely a proxy that has done its time. But what we know is that viewability still may mean that someone's not paying attention, and we can see that in our own data. So to be honest, there's plenty of studies around about this now, but in our own data, we see that, you know, on average, I think, you know, it's about 50% of the time when an ad is considered viewable that someone's even looking at it. So what we are doing now is the technology's better, right? So we're sort of outward facing versus inward facing, which is what viewability is. So I'm not saying that viewability is bad. I think it's done a fantastic job. But now that the technology is improved, you know, behavioral measures like, you know, attention, it sort of transcends those sort of inward facing measures like viewability.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that viewability is bad as such, or you know, I think people forget that it's opportunity to view. Maybe maybe they don't. Maybe this is me being naive, and it's an assumption. Maybe it's a mistake I make sometimes. Where viewable, even the word viewable, sort of means that you can see it.
Yeah, rather than having an opportunity. Genius marketers. Yeah. Anyone who, that's a genius play, because that's exactly what it is. It makes, in your own head, you think that if it's viewable, it's being viewed. Mm, yeah. But that's not actually the case. So that's a bit like when Facebook, you know, brought in the like button. It's a bit of a genius marketing effort. It means really not much at all. It doesn't mean you like the brand at all. It just means you happen to be around and engaged in it for 5 seconds. But I think viewability is a genius marketing play. But yeah, definitely with technology improving now. Put it this way, something has to be viewable for it to have any attention paid. So there's definitely that, but it just not good enough anymore. And there's tech that can kind of squeeze more value out of it for advertisers. And that's kind of the game we're playing or the game we're in.
One of the fun things about sort of running our site and being in our business that we've always traversed the two worlds of TV and sort of the online world, which has always been great for our events because we've had loads of scraps on stage over the years. So I'm really curious, you know, broadly speaking, which media channels do you think deliver the most attention to advertising? And are there any broad sort of rules of thumb that, you know, your money will always be well spent there? Obviously, there's a price consideration there, but yeah.
And a reach consideration. So and a reach always, consideration, yes, yeah, of course, so yeah. Those are the two extra variables that you have to include. Look, I'm not in the who wins the game argument much anymore, but I will say you asked me for rules of thumb. Yeah. I am a fan of television because, you know, it definitely gets more attention due to the fact that it's, you know, full screen, full sound. So it's 100% pixels, no spatial clutter. Usually sound on, you know, three big variables that actually have or play a big role in attention. So, you know, but with that said, I've been doing this long enough now that some of the formats that are coming out are trying to follow those rules. So, you know, I can't name names, but there's new work that we've brought out that shows that some of the newer full screen formats actually do really quite well. But, you know, at the same time, most of the digital formats don't have sound, you know, and then there might be a trade-off with reach and cost. So, you know, it's all of these factors. But, you know, if you think about the things that minimize distraction, that's the platforms, or those are the platforms that do the best.
Yeah. There isn't a social network that we can throw into the bus and say,
oh, my God,
work.
You're totally trying to get me. I'm going to get in so much trouble.
I won't push you anymore.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Is there any part of the media ecosystem that's undervalued? Let's frame it in a more positive way that maybe people overlook and there's a real hidden gem.
Well, I don't really want to, you know, be the trumpet in my own, you know, orchestra, but, you know, I think, and although the attention economy is becoming quite in hyperdrive at the moment, but I think advertisers or industry has yet, there are a few leaders in our space by all means in terms of agencies and brands, but human data, like understanding how much attention someone's paying, do never underestimate the value of that because we see it link to so many outputs. And, you know, we're trying to build products really fast on how to use this data from both a planning perspective. We put a planning format or platform out last year called Attention Trace, but we are fast tracking into the buying systems as well. So don't underestimate the value of that and how much additional efficiency it brings, or effectiveness, to viewability alone, that I say. But yeah, that's probably my answer on underrated.
Yeah. And when it comes to the industry awards, I mean, you mentioned the sort of awards at Cannes, and we should all be in Cannes at the moment, and we aren't. But do you think that these awards, you know, do they generally reward those that attract people's attention and pull them in, or is it more of a subjective, creative, artistic, intuitive thing that they judge on, do you think?
So it's interesting because I would argue, you know, having written a book on emotions about 7 years ago, I do actually believe that the majority of the winners and even, you know, the award contenders would have amazing attention-grabbing creative, but there are very few that then think about the translation to a sale. So I'll never forget, I was there a few years back, well, several years back, when the Geico ad was a winner, which was the one where Geico was literally, it was called Non-Stoppable or Non-Skippable or something along those lines. And there was, you know, a family who were eating spaghetti at a table, and within 1 second they had this big Geico, and then this dog jumped up, that they all sort of froze. I don't know if you remember this one, but they sort of froze as the family, while the dog kept going, and the dog jumped on the table and started eating the spaghetti while the family's sort of holding their knives and forks as if they were freezing. My point was, it was an award winner. It was really entertaining. It was brand right up front, but it was actually quite funny. So it was a bit of a winner-winner on all sides. So I think can definitely focus on the creativity side, but like I said, you could put an award winner on a poor platform and it get not much attention. So yeah, there's a difference between grabbing attention, but also then putting it on the right platform, but then also then making sure that it translates to a sale. So, you know, we sort of start to talk about this concept of reverse the reveal. So, you know, rather than a 15-second that reveals the brand at the end and it's all very, oh, my God, look at that, it's related to this brand, make sure that you sort of reverse the reveal, just like Geico did at the time, and have the perfect combination of you know, emotional, interesting, attention-grabbing, well-branded, good platform.
Yeah.
There you go.
I feel like I'm sort of sounding more negative towards creativity than I actually am on this. I'm sort of a firm believer, and we do something called Ad of the Week that features in our week in review, and I haven't been the one selecting the ads in recent years, but it was one of the highlights of my week, where you just see, you know, and there would be sort of maybe 5 to 10 ads from around the world in contention each week, and often all of them amazingly entertaining, creative, imaginative. And I think sometimes creativity gets a bad rap when there's actually great things going on.
Oh, look, I don't disagree with you. I just think, I know. So from the two sorts of sets of work that I've done around diffusion of content or gaining attention, I can see in the data. So for example, with viral, the idea that something went viral is actually a bit of a myth. The reality is that you have to seed content up front for it to have a longer tail. So what I know from that work, and it was 2 years of work, is that creative helps. So if something's emotional, it will sort of push the needle a little bit and give you a few more shares for your views. But if you don't seed it in the first place, it will never have the opportunity to get seen. So I know even from my own work that, you know, creative plays a role, but nowhere near as much as media placement.
Yeah. It's interesting what you're saying about viral videos. I mean, in the early days, when we started out as video ad news then, viral video was something I had to sort of speak to a lot of people about on a regular basis, and you could never quite get a firm answer on how it supposedly worked. What you were saying about seeding, I think, was the part that was often hitting, whereas it was always presented as it's this sort of alchemy that we understand and you don't. the way it was pitched for many years, but I'm glad it was sort of put to bed now. I can see the same thing now happening with influencers and all the rest of it, where people
even though the book was a few years back now, it will still hold because we used a lot of data, and it just shows the relationships between, you know, how many views you get up front versus how many people share it, and what that actually means to the shape of the distribution. So yeah, you'll have to put that one on your list.
it was slightly, I mean, just in terms of it, there were certain ads worth sharing. I mean, you couldn't constantly share the You might not be, I don't know if you're familiar with the Go Compare ad, but you know, you could see that all day, every day, and people aren't going to automatically start sharing it around. I mean, you do need to have the right type of creative asset, I assume.
100%. And that, so just, I know we're harping on this, but you know, if you have 100 people that see it, normal distribution might be that 25% of those people will share it, right? And then eventually it kind of gets to a point where it sort of dries up to zero people viewing, zero people sharing. But if you've got an ad that's creative, your ratio changes. So of the 100 people, you might get 50 people sharing. So what that means is your tail's longer and you get more reach in that period. So that's where creative comes in.
Yeah. Again, it's a question that, yeah, I've become accustomed to when I ask this, to sort of apologizing and adding a caveat that I don't ask it to male founders, but I think still think it's important if we're going to encourage more female founders in the industry. We don't really see enough. It does feel like we're seeing more, and I think that a culture around entrepreneurship is something that's building. But would you have any words of advice to other women who are thinking about starting up their own company?
Yeah, I think the concept of, you know, the culture of entrepreneurship isn't quite what I would say. I think what's changing is that women are comfortable, and some men are becoming more comfortable, that women have non-negotiables. I have children. I can't move. I have to base here. I travel a lot, but my non-negotiables are that I have to be here for my kids. They're big now, but, you know, when they were small. So I think there's a general acceptance that is what it is. I'm going to build a business around that and it's going to work and you're going to be flexible around me, versus, you know, even 10 years ago, I mean, just thinking about, you know, my working life and how inflexible some of my employers were, even though they talk about being family friendly, you know. So I think that life's changed because, you know, we do have, as women, you know, fairly significant non-negotiables to manage. But I think the world is becoming a bit more sort of accepting of those. So my advice to women are, if you are starting or wanting to start a business, do it now. And, you know, don't be embarrassed that you're juggling a baby on your lap when you're Zooming, when you're cooking at the same time. You know,
yeah,
that is our world, people. That is our world.
and I think the same probably, I mean, should be happening for men, where there's a huge amount in modern life that isn't really designed to make our lives better for fathers as much as mothers. I mean, I notice it though when we organize international events. You know, if it's like a few days away, it's really, really hard to get women with kids down for a few days. Whereas men, often with children, will say yes without even consulting their partner. You know,
yeah, that's
and that, you know, I think that probably needs to, yeah. It goes deeper. It goes into childcare, relationships, all the rest of it, you know.
Yeah, and I think, if I'm honest, I think that the pandemic has actually had a positive effect on that. I mean, if we want to take some positives from this horrible last 2 years, you know, for me, one of the positives has been that, you know, I live 24 hours away from you, maybe 25. And it's becoming more accepting that, you know, the year before I was on a plane every 6 weeks long haul, and it's pretty hard. So, you know, I think the pandemic has become a place where people are, you know, a time when people are a little bit more accepting of the need to be flexible. I mean, we're all working from home, but as an outcome of that, I think we've all sort of seen into people's lives. You know, I couldn't tell you how many times a kid's walked in and jumped on, you know, mum or dad, and we go, don't worry about it. You know, that's normal. That's our life. And, you know, someone will have to say, oh my God, I've got to go. Someone's screaming.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think if there's any positives, you know, it couldn't be a better time for a female to sort of go, you know what, I'm going to challenge the norm. I'm going to stick with my non-negotiables because this is my family and this is my life and this is where I live. But I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do it. And you have to be accepting of that.
I agree. I think it's good. I think a lot has been humanized. You can even see it in the posts on LinkedIn, some of which seem slightly barmy, but there's been a massive outpouring of openness and honesty and opening up about our failings.
Oh my God.
Sometimes to a questionable degree.
I have to tell you a failing. My cat, who I love dearly, brought in a mouse while I'm on a podcast or a video cast or webinar, and she brings it to my legs and drops it. And I don't know if you're a cat person, but you can hear them coming. They purr differently. They have this weird little chirpy purr. And I thought, oh my God, she's got something in her mouth. And sure enough, thank you very much, she just drops the mouse in my legs and off it runs. And I just like, yep, that's my, I just had to keep going, stage face.
There is the, I had a similar thing with somebody in the industry. He had gone out to his car to take the call. He said, I just have to come out to my car to get away from my kids. And by the end of the call, we're only speaking about 30 minutes, the little boy had wet his trousers. So he said, I've got the phone crooked under my chin, I'm holding wet trousers in one hand, then his daughter electrocuted herself on an electric fly swatter. No. That was quite, it was more of a stink, but she's screaming as well. I was just like, I have no kids.
And it was dad.
I was a great guy. was, but funny. Poor guy, it was just like that. Yeah, I was just waiting for the house to go on fire or something. It was just complete carnage. You realize what people are going
Love
through.
It.
But like I say, I think it's good. It's sort of, it's been a great reminder that we're all human. We've all got lives outside of what we do, and we should all make work fit our lives rather than make our lives fit work, which is what we've been doing, I think. So, final question. If I was to give you 10 million to invest in a company or a sector, where would you invest it and why?
It depends. I mean, is the question loaded? Because are you asking me whether I'm a good human or whether I'm a commercial soul?
Partly. That's partly. It's a great way to sort out the wheat from the chaff at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
People go,
oh. So,
okay, you're not allowed to give it to an orphanage. No.
Right. Okay. So, look, if I'm really honest, and this may seem biased, but this is... So, what you have to know about me is I'm really passionate about what we're doing. So we have an agenda, and our agenda is to make change in an ecosystem that's broken, which, you know, we're not curing cancer. We're not, you know, delivering pandemic injections, but I picked this a long time ago. So for me, I'm really passionate about the fact that our ecosystem is completely shattered. And that is the measurement industry in the media ecosystem. So if I'm really honest, I can see a massive category emerging right in front of my eyes between, you know, the fact that, you know, measurement's broken, you know, there's no independence, proxies don't cut it, but on top of that, the cookies are crashing and CPM doesn't cut it. So I would have to say, you know, any category that's about to explode, if you can see it, then I would say give $10 million to a business that's in a sector like ours.
Which I'm not
asking for investment. I'm just saying if I actually wanted to reinvest my own money, I would put it back into my own business because it's really a sector that's going to fly.
No, I think I've asked the question to various people, and it's I think I completely agree with you. I think measurement is going to be upended with everything that's going on, and that it's going to be more fragmented than ever, more confused. There's all this, you know, the continuing evolution of media formats, new social networks where, our ads work like this. All that stuff is fantastic for the likes of you who are able to solve for it.
Oh, thank you. And then there's the other side of me who I am committed to an electric vehicle change in my world. So other than that, $10 million into new energy. There you go.
Yep. I think Callum Smeaton from TV Squared had a similar ambitions. Anyway, on that note, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It was super fun. Loved it. Thank you so much.
Likewise, take care.